But hi, I'm Jose Luis Calderon, and been around these days for a few years as an adjunct. And before that, I was with Nova Southeastern University as an associate professor in the College of Pharmacy, where I was very much into pharmacoepidemiology. And before that, I was at Charles Drew as an associate. And so I've known Ron and Karen and Victor many years. We've met before. And so what I wanted to do today, because with everything that's going on, it's not unusual, it's not unexpected that attention hasn't been paid to public health consequences of what's going on. And so in teaching at pharmacoepidemiology and looking at the effects of drugs on populations and trying to hone in, I was focusing a lot on adverse drug events, adverse drug reactions. And as you'll see, there's a need for more information. I mean, it just is what it is. So what I want to do is begin at the beginning. I know this is just Epi 101, but it's quick, and then end off with pretty much a paradigm of how what we call the global, grip. It's a pipeline, a production and innovation pipeline. And that's where we have to start looking in order to see regulation be more standardized. One of the things that's happening internationally is the American Society for Testing and Medicines International, which I sit on their board, on the committee for developing international standards for cannabis. The International Organization of the International Standards Organization, ISO, is also in an effort to do the same, and so is the World Health Organization. So everybody's jumping on the bandwagon. What will be the standards that can be used internationally? Often we as a nation adhere to international standards. Right now we have no standards for the United States, no cohesive standard. Every state pretty much has its own regulatory standards, it has its own standards for who will get the opportunity to grow cannabis and sell cannabis. So in New York, it's still hugely nuts. In fact, de Blasio just last week came out with New York City's task force, on cannabis and cannabis health and what they are looking toward. And I agree with a lot of what he said. So let's just move on. We know epidemiology is studying the incidence and prevalence patterns of disease in populations. It really is the basic science of public health. Without epi, we wouldn't know what's going on with the public health, pretty much. It's a cornerstone methodology of public health research, and it's used in the entire process in public health. So why is that important? Because from there, from epidemiology, which is, it's amazing, it's been around a long time in England. What was the first public health school in London, I think it was, and then Hopkins opens its doors. That's where I did my graduate fellowship in NIPI. And it's so important, it's helped us so much in understanding how disease is caused because of use, exposures, etc. So from there, not long ago, came the concept of pharmacoepidemiology. And the reason I'm doing this, and let me just say, preface this presentation by saying that I'm going to use pharmacoepi as an example of what we need to do to establish a field in phytoepidemiology. Why? We'll get to that. But if we don't see what's going on with pharmacoepidemiology and the study and use and effects of drugs in large numbers of people, which is what the International Society of Pharmacoepidemiology calls it. That's their definition. I'm not in agreement with that, because there's so much more than large numbers of people. What does that mean? So we feel a better definition is the study of population level incidence and prevalence of adverse drug events, ADEs, caused by pharmaceutical drugs, specifically synthetic drugs and devices. So it's not really just drugs anymore. So it really has to do with all these devices that are being developed in pharmacy as well that cause fatal adverse drug events, adverse events, because ADEs are also known as just adverse events. If you include devices, you're saying adverse drug events and doesn't apply to devices. So in general, saying adverse events is where it's at. So pharmacoepidemiology is, the basis of it is post-marketing surveillance. So what do we have now happening with cannabis? The doors have just been opened with the Farm Bill approval for so many companies to grow hemp. How are you, Ish?
Good, how are you
doing? What's
his name? Bala.
Who's a fellow and doing a project, very interesting project on the use of cannabis in elite athletes. Mm. And I'm very excited about it. I got your email, I'll get back to you on that.
Cool. All right. Thanks.
So, the whole issue of post-marketing surveillance, what is that? FDA pretty much mandates reporting adverse drug events by pharmaceutical companies. If you market something, you now put up the money to do some surveillance. And what the pharmaceutical companies do, one of the things is looking for what we call sentinel events. Something that happened out of the ordinary where the flag went up and you start sort of seeing if these reports are coming in. But these reporting, although mandatory for pharmaceutical companies and for hospitals, because there's a system in place in every state, nationally, for hospitals, they must report AEDs. They must report them. It's a measure of the quality of care at some level, but it could also be a measure of the quality of one aspect of care, such as nursing or whatever. And it's usually done by collection of spontaneous case reports. And Federal Drug Administration's Adverse Event Reporting System, FAERS, and MedWatch are in place for a long time. But what's the problem with that? We don't understand the epidemiology of pharmaceutical AEDs because it's voluntary reporting versus mandatory.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Okay.
So when you have a system, you're looking for sentinel events, you're looking for adverse drug events, and it's voluntary, then you know right there, we do not know. Because of all the events that do occur out there in communities, not just hospitals, it's mandated that they report, but all the adverse events people experience with drugs at home or wherever they go, that they do not report. So we have, I'm not even sure if it's a nationally represented sample, Ron, because it's, the voluntariness of it is barrier. There has to be some more strict standardizing of how to report. If you go on the FDA FAERS, for example, the FDA adverse event recording system, and you read that document, you know what the readability is? How difficult it is to read? 16 to 20 grade level. So the average person who wants to get on to report an adverse drug event or an adverse event from a device will not understand what they're reading. It's highly unlikely. So that's a barrier, and one of the things that we need to look, we talked about this, Ron, looking at Department of Health and Human Services, looking at government agencies, how difficult is it for the average person to understand how can I report this? Or how do I understand what the CMS and Medicaid and Medicare information? Well, it turns out some of this stuff is very difficult to read. So voluntary reporting can be a barrier. Now, what does that have to do with cannabis? We are going to have post-marketing surveillance. And everybody said, well, weed does not cause any problems. And I agree, I mean, it's safe. I'm pro-weed. I'm a flower child, by the way. But at the same time, you can't say nobody ODs off of weed. Why? Anyone jump in on that one? I mean, how do you define an overdose? Okay, well, we'll get to that. How do you define an overdose? Doesn't mean you have to die. You just smoke too much and maybe you got paranoid. You're driving. Most fatalities now related to cannabis are MVAs and use of heavy machinery. So moving on, let's move on this. All right, so one quick note about adverse drug events. It's a hidden public health concern. First of all, we don't know a lot about it because we're not getting a lot of reporting. It's like everything nationally run. The surveys, the CAP surveys are working on, with Karen as well. It's the fact that the non-response rate is going up, fewer people responding to these important surveys, fewer people reporting adverse drug events. But this study by Lazaro, Pomeranz, and Quarry, 20 years old. And I have looked every 6 months for the last 20 years for any meta-analysis that compares to that, and I only found it about in 2007, I'll get to that. They reported, this is basically adverse drug events in hospitals. 150,000 deaths per year, fourth largest cause of mortality. 2.2 million hospitalizations. This was 20 years ago. 20 to 70% preventable, right? Fourth largest cause of death, where's the ribbon? I'm fond of saying that. Where is the ribbon? We have more people die from adverse drug events at that time than breast cancer and colorectal cancer combined. So why is it such a hidden problem? Will we have the same problem with cannabis? I suspect so. I suspect that there's going to be some very deep things happening in the future with cannabis. In fact, it would have probably been safer to leave the black market alone. And, you know, go to the usual dealer, pick up your, you know, lid, pick up your Z. You know, in New York City, you can carry 25 grams or less, it's legal. That's almost an ounce, short by 3 ounces. But this is important because if it's an issue now, if it's an issue now with pharmacy, what's going to happen with cannabis where everybody believes it's not as dangerous? And yet, the only other study was I retrieved it this month, was in 2007 by Wester, Johnson, Spigset, Hogg, and they're in Sweden. That's the only other population-based study, meta-analysis. This was a population-based study, not a meta. And they found that approximately 5% fatal events with drugs. 5% of the of fatal events, you know, incidence of fatal adverse drug reactions, the prevalence is 5% of people who take drugs. That's huge. What are those numbers like? So how does it relate to cannabis? Again, can you die from using cannabis? Is there a mortality? Yes, there is. And it's not just machinery, motor vehicles. And we'll talk about that. This whole pipeline, we're in cultivation, in processing through extraction, in manufacturing, there are risks involved in what's put out there that can actually kill you. So we'll get to that. This was very important. The incidence of fatal drug reactions in the general population is largely unknown. This is with pharma, and pharma has been here. We're just kicking this off. That we know basically zip. So what do? We must establish a phytoepidemiology, and we must specifically establish a cannabis phytoepidemiology as a field of study. It's not going anywhere. At yesterday's meeting with the initiative here in UCLA, I suggested, and I suggested it before, the medical students must take some sort of education on cannabis now. Now, you know, oh, where are we going to put it in the curriculum? I've heard that forever. Isn't it the usual excuse? Well, they're loaded. Are you kidding me? I was doing call every third night when I was a med student. Kids now, what is it, every once a week? I don't know. Once every five? I know my nephew's wife, who just finished her residency, told me, no, we were on call like once a week. I said, wow. So you tell me you can't take a course at home, get online? Yes, you can, because one of the things that the initiative, the Health Plan Cannabis Initiative is doing is developing a curriculum for certification for providers in New York. And those sorts of courses should be taught to medical students so that they are better prepared as practitioners. And also very much linked to that is health literacy for the consumer. So there's a lot to do. There's a lot to do. Let's move on. So phytoepidemiology, what is that? Well, we define it as a study of the use of plant-derived and plant-based molecules, phytocules. And with every new field comes new language. And that's one of the exciting things about this. I can make up words But they make sense. The poor, they would post mandos in the French, where you just take, and for improving health. So using follicles for improving health and the incidence and prevalence, and we should look at the incidence and prevalence of adverse events they may cause. So not only about the incidence and prevalence, but use. How does use then cause adverse events? How often do we see them? And why prevalence? Because as in pharmacoepidemiology, some of these reactions stay with you. You may get Stevens-Johnson syndrome in the hospital from adverse drug event, from an allergic reaction, which is fatal in many cases. And then you may have ADEs that cause morbidity, whereby, say, even with statins for cholesterol, rhabdomyolysis, where you now you're weak and your muscles are weakened for life. So is this relevant to cannabis? Absolutely, absolutely. Phytoceuticals versus pharmaceutical. Plant-derived versus synthetic. Phytocule versus molecule. Although a phytocule is a molecule is not necessarily a phytocule. You follow me? Because I can go to the lab, and when I was doing organic chemistry as a senior in college, when we just had these exercises where how do we get this molecule? How do we synthesize this? And in third year, in the first exposure to organic, is here, so this liquid, it's an unknown identifier. So you can pretty much put together these days, we have the technology, any molecule. If you can identify it in a plant, you can reproduce it. Phytocule versus molecule, phytotherapeutics versus pharmacotherapeutics. Phytotherapeutics as opposed to chemotherapeutics. In Flavicure Biotech, it's on their advisory board, dedicated to the use of flavonoid molecules from cannabis to treat cancers right now. They have patented an orphan drug to treat pancreatic cancer. And they're going to third stage clinical trials. And it's amazing, what we did is we linked up with Harvard, where I went to school, Harvard Medical School, and they were doing research using drones. It turns out we have trouble with a delivery system in mouse models. So did the research, and sure enough, drones helped to deliver this molecule that was identified by Dr. Enge Toyang and Dr. Henry Low. And this delivery, you could see the difference in the first study compared to the seconds. And so it's very important that we understand the difference between, we want to distinguish between pharmaco and phyto. It's not the same. One of the issues is, you may have heard about the entourage effect, where CBDs, cannabidiol, which has now been approved for two forms of seizure disorders in children, Drake syndrome and the Lennox-Gastaut, which very refractory. I've had patients at NYU when I did my residency, then neuro. It's heartbreaking to see a kid have all these seizures. So the pharmacotherapeutics were not working. These kids were talking about 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds on 4, 5, 6 different anti-epileptic drugs. Some of them experimental, sick. They did the clinical trials, which was an open trial. It was not, everybody did it their own way in different centers, but they used the same amount of CBD, and it cut the seizures by 40%. We're talking about kids having 10, 11, 12 seizures a day, every hour, every 2 hours. It must be hard on the parents. So I believe it's very important as we move forward in defining this field of cannabis phytoepidemiology, that we have language that's commensurate with that, to distinguish it from pharmacoepidemiology. Although you may say there's still a drug, yes, but that drug is in a different environment. Those cannabinoids are in an environment with flavonoids and terpenes. And the terpenes, as well as the flavonoids, act as...
Hi.
Upstairs. They act synergistically. Let me repeat that. Those cannabinoids within themselves, CBD and THC, actually are synergistic. A little bit of THC actually helps kick off the CBD effect. And the CBD helps to temper the psychoactive effects of THC. So they call that the entourage effects. Rafael Menachem, who was from Israel, was the one that discovered the endocannabinoid system and CBD, also coined the term entourage effect. But we hear about it with cannabinoids, but we're not hearing about it with flavonoids and terpenes, and that's one of the things we're digging into now and see what's done. So do you follow that? The importance of developing language when you're proposing a new field of study that's actually built on previous field of study, pharmacoepidemiology, which builds on pharmacology and epidemiology that was also portmanteau and put together. Does that make sense so far? I mean, should we just say, oh, it's part of pharmacoepidemiology? I was told that years ago. I said, absolutely no way. No way. For one, just the difference between plant-derived and synthetic. You take the molecule out of its normal environment where it has other molecules signaling, name it, and that help it do what it does and make it synthetic. There's no way they can be exactly the same. But let me share something with you, because this is a good example. This is a note on nutraceuticals. You hear nutraceuticals, TV, you know, all these nutraceuticals that are being sold. What are they? Well, Merriam-Webster says they're foodstuffs, fortified food, or dietary supplement, providing health benefits in addition to their basic nutritional value. This must be included as one of the objectives of phytoepidemiology. Why? Some of these nutraceuticals are actually combinations of plants and other things, and they're not purely phytoceuticals. An example of this, Reggie's rice. And this is important because there are similar things can happen with cannabis, with aflatoxins, E. coli, Campylobacter, where you can get sick with edibles. And it's not being discussed yet. It is, but not in the general way where everybody has it on their agenda. Yeah, this is something else. Red yeast rice is basically a yeast that grows well on rice. But, so we have a myco molecule made from a yeast, right? Now, that red yeast rice nutraceutical, I checked it out in different pharmacies, I read, they don't tell you everything that's in it, because that yeast produces monoclonal K, which is a molecule that is also known as lovastatin. Lovastatin is a statin drug that was marketed as Mevacor by Merck before it became Merck Sharp & Dohme. Now, if somebody who doesn't understand that, and it's the same thing with cannabis, this is why I use this example. If they don't understand that and they're on a statin, and now they say, red yeast rice helps lower your cholesterol. The perception is that these nutraceuticals are harmless. But now you start using red yeast rice on top of your statin, high risk for hepatic necrosis, high risk for just the rhabdomyolysis from statins, and some of them are fatal. So we need to include nutraceuticals in the study of if it's a yeast, then why should that be in phytoepidemiology? Because that yeast cannot grow without something like a grain like rice. So there is a plant grain component, a food component, by which that yeast, and aflatoxins are the same way with grains. They grow in corn and they're very dangerous. They're the most hepatotoxic, carcinogenic molecule we know to men. And this can happen with cannabis. So, to take the posture that, hey, weed is safe. Hey, they're making it and they're labbing it. Well, that's not true, because Arizona doesn't require labbing. And we'll get to that. And so they could put anything they want on that oil, or in that oil, or in that balm, or in that little ice cream that New York, they started selling ice cream with CBD. That might work, I don't know. So But to define it, cannabis phytoepidemiology, you can see from epidemiology to pharmacoepidemiology to phytoepidemiology, now specifically cannabis phytoepidemiology. It's a study of the use and effects of cannabis on populations. The incidence and prevalence of cannabis-related adverse events. The study of exposure to contaminants and waste products. The study of environmental consequences of cannabis waste. And I'll say, yeah, but cannabis is biodegradable. It's not so simple. It really isn't. A few months ago at the ASTMI meeting, this was discussed, and just last month we had a ballot on, one was on standardizing packaging and labeling, and the second was on waste management. And the waste management ballot, which is like a paper, it's long, and we have to contribute to pretty much what we do when we review papers, we edit, we help edit, add to it, although we're not just reviewing, we're actually responsible for adding to it. One of the things I brought up was, and when I reviewed the ballot, before they make it a standard, they require education, of course, at different stages of the pipeline. But they don't discuss who is going to do the teaching, what is going to be in the curriculum, and that is why developing a standardized curriculum that contains information not just for providers, but similar information for consumers is hugely important. And I'm very disappointed that New York State regulatory processes regarding cannabis did make a decision last year that physicians to get certified to prescribe cannabis no longer need to take 4 hours classes, but 2 hours would suffice. Are they out of their mind? Well, this is one of my missions when I get back to New York. De Blasio just had his task force report released last week. We need to sit down. We need to sit down. There's no way you're going to learn about epidemiology, and that must be taught to understand the public health effects. Remember, that is the basic science. That is the main tool of epidemiology, of public health, I mean.
All right, so that's how we would define it. Any other way? Anything anybody here would add to that?
Ron, is there some, in terms of epi? This, which is one of the things I'm looking for from the, would this cover the, not the whole gamut, I guess, but pretty much I think it captures most of what we need to be looking for. Certainly, again, as with pharmacoepidemiology, we will need post-marketing surveillance. So how do we do it? FDA hasn't approved it as, you know, hasn't rescheduled it, let me say. So it's not legal nationally. So the FDA is not going to spend money to develop a post-marketing surveillance system. Who's going to do it? And how is it going to be done? Nobody's talking about this, ladies and gentlemen. That's why it's such a exciting thing to propose a new area of study. And now with that, good research questions beget good research questions. Good research begets good research questions. And tons of questions that we need to answer in order to actually follow where all of these farms are popping up. Canada is replete with them. Mexico just legalized cannabis and is looking for help on how to process, you know, how to cultivate, because why is they have a pretty much state-of-the-art pharmaceutical facilities in Mexico, but they need help now. And I sat at a meeting in Jamaica not long ago, a few months ago, with FlavorCure Biotech, and they came and from Mexico there's a pharmacist and a gentleman named Luis Gomez. He's basically working with the government because they need help. You see, all the weed used to come in from, I call it weed, cannabis used to come in from Mexico. You know, Mexico had a bad rep for being that sort of weed in Jamaica. So the West Coast, you got mostly Mexican. On the East Coast, you got mostly Jamaican. There's no high power stuff, you know, in those days. They're rare. So they are not prepared at all, and yet it's coming. So what's going to happen? I mean, what's going to happen when we don't know even how to actually process and have standards for processing? Cannabis related, let's talk about that. A cannabis-related adverse event is any noxious, unintended, or undesired effect of cannabis. Let me stop right there. All right. The cannabis you can get today, even from your local homeboy, some really good stuff. They're very powerful, high in THC, high in terpenes. You met Jared and Spencer, and we had a round table a couple of months ago. We brought people from every sector in cannabis production, and it was a wonderful discussion. Wonderful discussion. They came from Jamaica, they came from Canada. We had a wonderful discussion, which really helped kick me off now, that we do need to fight a weapon. And undesired, you have a kid, he goes and gets some high-powered stuff, high 50% THC, 50% terpenes, and then rolls a blunt, which is a cigar wrapper, which is horrible. First of all, that's one of the potential adverse problems with smoking cannabis. Not the cannabis itself, but what you smoke it in. Vaping. Let me show you something. I wish I'd have brought the other stuff. I got props, you know. I don't have any weed, don't worry. Imagine, pass that around. Don't inhale, folks. This is says West Coast Vape Company, right? You know, superior breed, keep out of reach of children. That's it. This is insufficient labeling. If should this have been a pharmaceutical molecule, you have package insert that nobody could read anyway, because the font is like this, so this visual display design is ridiculous. Imagine, especially people in our age group, in mid-60s, where our vision, come on, I could not see that. So I think that's one of the standards that, you know, in our committee at ASTM, is that we should have package insert. If you have a bottle that's big enough to give you that information, that's fine. But not, because sometimes they sell the little dabbing, just for dabbing. We'll get into what dabbing is. Is that up there? Not yet. But
what do they consider to be children?
I'm sorry?
What do they consider to be children? What's the age range on that?
Children. I'm sorry.
What's the age range on children? What are they?
In using?
Yeah.
Right now, we've seen adolescents, we're talking about 10-year-old kids smoking.
10?
Vaping. First of all,
But the directions on that, what are they?
Oh, they don't mention it.
I thought you said for children, they couldn't use children.
That's not wrong.
It just says children, though, right? It doesn't say
any age. They have to read the children.
So what would they, I got it. Yeah, what do they say the age range? Yeah, they don't have any age range?
I don't know what's in that stuff.
What would you consider to be a child?
Sorry,
they're not explicit about what a child is,
exactly.
Right? They just say children.
Exactly. That's one of the problems with labeling. Well, who is a child?
Yeah, who's a child?
I think
a 15-year-old is a child.
15?
15,
that's 16,
yeah.
They don't consider themselves.
I'm 64, man. I'm in my prime. But it's one of the things that I'm very huge on the issue of standards. And we need to have standards for labeling because, again, you may be smoking something and it says on your smoking CBD, maybe something else in it that contaminates, and then we'll get to that. So, cannabis related adverse events, any noxious, unintended, smoke too much, got paranoid. Come on, I remember when I was 15, the first time I smoked, and to say, not to admit that is ridiculous, I'd be remiss. And I just sat there like, oh my God, oh my God. And I was in my friend's place, and he was listening to Led Zeppelin coming. I heard it coming out of the walls. Whole Lot of Love. It was like blew my mind. And then I said, wait, I got to chill out.
Well, your tolerance level was also very low. Your tolerance level was pretty low as well.
Pardon?
Your tolerance level was pretty low as well.
Oh, yeah. The use throughout school, use was, come on. I mean, we were late 60s, early 70s. Peace, love, and light up a bone.
But nobody knew.
No, nobody knew. But and you didn't hear about anybody really.
It's like smoking in the 30s and 40s. Yeah. Nobody knew it was bad for you.
Yeah, and there are people having, getting paranoid all the time. You heard about that. Maybe paranoid because it was just too much for the system. Now, we have an endocannabinoid system that's part of our bodies. And we make cannabinoids in our bodies. Hmm. And it's sort of a natural, well,
Kind of like cancer cells run our bodies all the time until they activate.
So imagine your system has more receptors, cannabinoid receptors that are two identified, one and two, they call them. And you just smoke, you have fewer receptors than I do. We smoke the same amount, but I'm getting blasted and you're like mellowed out. So there's issues you have to look at. One, that our kids should not be smoking in school. You know, honestly, you're not going to study. I don't know, so many of us parents went through this with our kids. You do your homework, yeah. My eyes are so red. Nothing, Papi, I'm okay. And I said, oh boy, come here, let's have this talk. You know, wait, if you're going to do something, we figured was pretty much harmless. In fact, honestly, as a parent, if my kid, he's 16, 17, smoked a little pot, I'd rather have that than him drinking liquor. The lesser of two evils. And I'm not sure cannabis is an evil. I think it's actually a blessing. You know, I really do. Why? Because it's going to be able to offset a lot of those pharmaceutical drugs. And from where I stand, that's the mission. Get people off those drugs that kill and onto something that natural that God put on this earth.
But you have to be diagnosed first. You should be diagnosed with something before you start just smoking.
No, well,
you know what I'm saying.
If you go that route, if you go to a doctor, and first of all, I'll give you New York State as an
example. Psychiatrist, somebody like that.
New York State is way behind in their benchmark for how many physicians would be certified. Why? Because many physicians in practice, or providers, whether it be PAs or certified nurse practitioners, are concerned they may lose their license because the feds could step in at any time and say, you know, you can't practice.
Well, what about they're writing the medical?
If you can do it, states' rights allow it.
Okay.
But there's still the stigma and the fear. Oh, stigma, back to Mexico. Because in Mexico, there was such a stigma with cannabis that all the families who can afford to put their kids to school, who became professionals, like doctors or providers, they never even dealt with cannabis. And I asked them a frank question in that contingent, what is it that you need? They said, we don't know anything about it, how to grow it, how to extract it. And that's what the Lowe's Biotech, which is another biotech that I work with, and informally, you know, just as on an advisory board capacity. And they're also helping the people in Mexico. So it's a good thing that they sought the help and didn't do it on their own and without learning what to do. So all this noxious, unintended, undesired effects of cannabis do happen when using humans for prophylaxis, therapy, or recreation. It's really by exposure to cultivation. If you work in cultivating, California is strict, has its regulations. You must wear a mask. You can't just be, cultivating the leaves, and you can actually get high in some of these greenhouses because the microns are these little crystalline oils that are on the leaves. And if you handle them without gloves, you absorb them. And those are the terpenes. One way that one person in the industry described terpene high is that it's a body high, not a head high. I thought that was interesting. Because no, you feel it more in your body than you do like in your head. You know? Processing, extracting molecules, flavonoids, terpenes, or cannabinoids from the plant. Using extracting machines that are closed systems to reduce the amount of fumes that could come out because exposure to them can be harmful. Well, how do you extract? I didn't want to get deep into it, but there's many ways to extract these molecules from any plant. You have all eaten, as I have. If you look at the labels of foods, you know, this extract, that extract, that extract, okay? So the favorite one, truly, is using hydrocarbons like hexane and butane to extract.
Propylene, glycol.
Yeah.
Propylene?
Propylene, yeah. All those hydrocarbons, which now contaminate the extract. So what do? The thing you have to do now is get it labbed, and we'll talk about that. If it's too high, it gets rejected, you can't sell it. People lose millions of dollars that way. But there's ways of cleaning it that we're looking into. Why can't we use other chalk? You can do what's called supercritical, which is actually taking the flour, they ground it, it's always dried and ground before it's put into these extractors. And this, what this does, under high pressure and sub-zero temperatures, like minus 140, it actually extracts. Yeah,
question? No.
Oh, it's and it comes out cleaner. Pretty much what the organic dry cleaners do is supercritical. It's in that area. They call it organic, nothing added like the hydrocarbons. You might recall how cleaners used to smell. If you go to those organic, they don't. And manufacturing, again, you know, handling these things, creating, well, consumption, we spoke about creating waste. How do we get rid of the waste? It's an incredible process, I kid you not. You have to differentiate between the flower and the leaves and the stalks, how they can be disposed of, whether they have to be destroyed or like incinerated, whether they may be included for compost, whether they may be actually disposed of in the usual way with your own garbage. But the fact is that the more this grows, and the more this grows, the more we're going to have cannabis waste to deal with. And clearly, some of that cannabis waste is contaminated. No way. A lot of that does not pass labbing cannot move forward in the process. If cultivating, if they find pesticides, well, let's get to that part of it.
So,
residues from manufacturing. In the flower, pesticides, bacteria, molds, mycotoxins. The first thing that must be done is lab.
And Victor, this is when I want to go to that other slide for a second. Let me just show you a slide and to help you sort of visualize this pipeline.
That's weird, why is it not showing?
I guess you can.
I'm not sure why it's not showing it. We're still figuring out the technical side of things here.
New offices, new equipment.
Yeah. All our fancy equipment in this building. Yeah, I don't know why it's doing that.
Can you just put it on Word?
It's not changing that.
Bypass the little Word?
Yeah, I don't know why it's not doing it. It's not changing. It's supposed to be showing up there.
And I think this is an important figure to chew on for a minute. It took me some time to put together different renditions of it. We know when we should lab. After you cultivate, before you get to extraction, you must lab by a third party and be certified, get a certificate for analysis that you passed. After which you can do the extracting, and after you extract, again you must lab.
This thing
now what are you looking for? We're not looking for the bacteria, we're not looking for the pesticides, and that second labbing, although the labs all just do all of them, it's easier, but they're looking for the butanes, the polyethylenes, the other hydrocarbons, and some states allow certain levels. There you go. So this is what we call the Global Green Rush Innovation and Production Pipeline, and the Global GRIP Pipeline. It turned out that GRIP, the word GRIP was in there, so we took advantage of it. But it truly has a grip on the world when you think about it. Everybody's just into the cannabis craze. And the bottom line is there's going to be a lot of innovation involved. A lot of innovation is going to be involved in developing ways to extract that are cleaner. In labbing tech, well, labbing is about the use of liquid chromatography that separates out molecules according to their molecular weight, whereby the heavier molecules move slower, so you can actually separate them out. And then you can, by mass spectroscopy, you get bands, and the heavy band, by mass spectroscopy, you identify them by their, well, the spectroscopy gives you a pattern, and that's how you know if it's CBD or if it's THC or if it's a flavonoid. You know, there's also the production aspect. So production in any field begets innovation, inventions. And with that comes changes in safety issues, regulatory issues, state by state, which are lacking. So after cultivation, we need third-party testing, third-party distribution for lab testing, third-party certified lab testing. So before you distribute, after you do something, you have to test. Now, most states require that right now who have legalized marijuana. However, Arizona is a state that, to my knowledge, still does not have any regulations, or you don't have to lab your products. I don't buy weed in Arizona. Don't know what they're putting in it. Once you extract, you have to do third party again. So then you come up and you have flowers and oils and edibles and creams, and that's where the public health issues may develop by a consumption and exposure that we spoke about. And there lies the need for a cannabis phytoepidemiology. Since it's a public health issue, epi being the basic science, the major tool for public health, has to be involved. We talked about cannabis phytotherapeutics with terpenes, cannabinoids, and flavonoids, three major classes of molecules in the plant. There's over 200 terpenes, 120 or more cannabinoids. How they work with each other is hugely important. As I mentioned, when you isolate something from that soup, I look at it as a soup, a cellular soup, a phyto soup. They're not separated. They're all floating around in that cytoplasm. And if you remove one, and they have an effect on each other, signaling effects, synthesis, that signaling modulates synthesis. It's, for example, THC acid is you won't get high on it. But if you just let the plant sit and age, there's a decarboxylation of the chemical moiety, see, with a carbon, two oxygens, and a hydrogen, and now it becomes that delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, and now it gets you high. So all those things are very important to understand, and what terpenes are good for and how they interact with cannabinoids and how they affect your endocannabinoid system. So that the cannabinoids, how do they act in that? So we're looking at all of that. In fact, I truly believe that a lot of CBD products should contain flavonoid or terpene as an entourage, as a synergistic, as an adjuvant to help it work better. And so that's going to take some time, and you might be interested in that kind of thing in the future. Post-marketing surveillance, we spoke about that. I think it's going to be difficult. Right now, the feds are not kicking up the money. They're not going to spend any money on something they consider illegal. But they are, the epitome of hypocrisy. They are. They let pharma kill people, but they won't let us. Now some states are doing it, taking the law into their hands, right? but they're going against the feds. California, whatever the feds do, California does. So you don't, you want to understand this here? Just look at military standards. But now, hemp is legal. And you can make CBD from hemp because it contains such a small amount of THC. It's negligible, it's like 0.3%. So, and that is the law. In order to call it hemp, it can't contain more than 0.3, you know, otherwise they're afraid somebody might get high. Hemp actually was not meant for consumption. Hemp was meant for developing textiles, ropes, manufacturing clothing, really. And so the law said you cannot use hemp or derive anything from hemp for consumption. But now that's changed with the Farm Bill and all, whatever the piggybacking they do in Congress on both sides of the aisle. Now you can extract CBD. So there are some companies, like I met with a gentleman who, from a company called Floria, said who is the largest distributors of CBD. And even have on their bottle, I have his card, 0% THC, like advertising it. Well, some people don't want to, anything to do with the psychoactive effect. So they are involved in very interesting innovations, powders with CBD and to make energy drinks and you can make yourself. He showed me a sample of, looked to me like about a gram. And I said, so what, I said, what's the concentration here? In this powder of CBD, he said about 20% of it is CBD. I said, this is high in terpenes. What's the other 80%? Terpenes give flowers their smell, their odor. There, a lot of terpenes are meant to ward off insects and that sort of thing. And I could smell it. I said, well, this is high terpenes. And if I were to sell this, this should be labeled. I said, what about the labeling for the company? So we went back and forth with Clark Swanson, in fact, on that. Clark Swanson is Flavor Cures. Senior vice president.
So I don't want to interrupt you, but can you? So what right now is going on is kind of like the Wild West, right? So you don't know, if you could just say some of the dangers, because you kind of hinted at them, but what are some of the most likely dangers of people now using cannabis?
I think the most likely dangers are right here. In the cultivation,
well, users of the users.
In other words,
what's going to happen? Like they get in, what situation would be most likely to happen?
If you're exposed to butanes or hydrocarbons, you may not get immediately ill, but they are carcinogenic, as are the aflatoxins that might result from cultivating. If the dried flower has more than 10% water, you know, then they measure the water. Then it's like more likely to grow fungi, yeasts, things like that. But in terms of what will be the most likely, that's why we need the post-marketing surveillance. We don't know how many bad reactions there have been from pharmaceutical drugs. We don't know. We know it's high. But I believe what we need to do is lay the foundation now so that we can, once the feds fess up, you know, and then quit the hypocrisy, then we'll be ready. We're not getting ready to get ready. We will be ready. We have to do that. What else could happen? Well, one of the things that I'm concerned with is that there is such a high growth of small companies that want to get in, make money, that they will be cutting short, back on, they're going to cut corners. And there's also a black market that's thriving. Cannabis is a cash business. You cannot use a credit card at a dispensary. It's kind of a joke. When I was in Jamaica, I went to a dispensary, check it out. And I walked in, it's like a boutique, all very nice, and it's just very nice, and not too expensive compared to here. And I'm just pricing things. And I said, so what's the procedure that I have to see a doctor for 1,500 Jamaican? In 2 minutes, you know, he said, you know, I was with a guy who took me there. He's a cousin of my wife's friend. So he said, man, that guy will see you for 1 minute. Why are you here? Well, I've been having pain, no problem. There you go. And I think those sorts of things are going to happen because it happens now. What a doctor. I'm an MD, okay? I spent most of my career in medicine, in practice, when I after training in family medicine and in neurology, de-prescribing, taking people off drugs to make them feel better. I am really, pharma has a place. I really believe that there are medicines that are helpful and are important. But now, when you look at the television today, how many drug commercials do you see? All monoclonal antibodies. These drugs are targeting the epigenome. They're targeting DNA. You know, but when you open up, when you deacetylate the epigenome for one gene and it opens up, it also opens up others. And why those monoclonal antibody drugs that they're pumping out every day, there's a new one. It's amazing, it's amazing. Yet there are alternatives with things like cannabis and other plants, not just cannabis. Why phytoepidemiology is the umbrella area of study, and cannabis phytoepidemiology being a sub-area. Is it any more dangerous than other flowers? I think that red yeast rice is much more dangerous than cannabis. You don't hear about mortality from overdose in the sense that you took too much and your body shut down as with a narcotic. It's respiratory depression. You don't hear about that. In fact, cannabis is now being studied for taking people off opioids, helping. And I can tell you a personal story that about 5 years ago, my brother did his life in the military, got injured in overseas, got home. Immediately, the VA started pumping him with opioids. He became addicted, not functioned. I said, this is my brother. And then I helped him get off opioids, or minimize them because he needs them. He's been seriously injured with cannabis. And it was not legal. I just asked him, you know anybody that has any cannabis? He goes, yeah, one of my buddies from overseas, you know. And he got some, and he hadn't smoked for 40 years. And it helped him. And so what are we going to see, Ron? I think we're going to see, first of all, there needs standardization, right? Because if Colorado recently lowered its standards for the amount of hydrocarbons that they allow, the state of Colorado is allowing more hydrocarbons in the product than before. Why is that? Because their people were not passing the labs. If they don't pass the lab testing, they can't sell their product, the state can't tax it. This is my understanding. So they said, okay, we're gonna allow a little more of those hydrocarbons. So when you vape, you're vaping more. Because after you extract using the hydrocarbons, then you use alcohol to distill it into the oil. You can also extract using alcohol and alcohol residues. Excuse me, and the good way to go is thermal. It's called thermal extraction, with vaporized heat, heated vapors going through the plant, the grounded plant, and actually the yield is greater. It's just more expensive. So from the people I've spoken to in the industry, the best product is with the hydrocarbons. The texture and what you can do with it in terms of manufacturing, and they just think that's the way to go, except they have to clean it. They have to find ways to clean it after. And so I'm working one group here on how to do that. I think clearly the supercritical is a good way to go. It's expensive as well, the machinery. But it's worth, if you want to hydrocarbon extract, supercritical after. Clean it up. You know, you don't need, the only thing about using supercritical is going to do a small amount at a time, a small batch, as opposed to using the hydrocarbons where you can take larger batches into these extractors. So there, so we will find in the future that it is a safe plant, but it may be unsafely processed. It may be used incorrectly, and that can cause harm. Will it cause death? If people start driving and this, bottom line is your reaction time is going to be distorted.
you're moving at 65, 75 miles an hour, and something happens in front of you, you're not going to tell me. I mean, honestly, I know people who've gotten 60 DUIs, I said, well, after the first one, why didn't you, like, get it in the car accident, right? And they were responsible, and they just didn't get it. They thought they drove better or something on alcohol, which is crazy. You drive drinking or drunk, let's say, intoxicated, you're like a loaded gun. So if anybody that smokes, say a kid, my grandson, my oldest grandson, my child, he's 17, just got his license in Florida, and we had the talk. Don't drink and drive. Because it's illegal just to drink and drive in California. Most people don't know that. They think about the point eight. No, it's illegal to drink at all. So you get a ticket anyway, even though you're not getting cuffed, you know, and taken to jail, you're still going to get a ticket. So the same thing may happen with cannabis. Innovation, find ways to test people, but how are we going to do that? If I smoked this morning something like regular, my THC level is going to be low. If I smoked 3 days ago some powerful stuff with terps, it may be higher. I mean, how are we going to do, and you know, the same thing we do with alcohol? It's not going to happen. Not anytime soon anyway, but that's innovation. But that pretty much sums up what I want to share. You know, it's defining an area that we should look at. And I actually reached out to the American Journal of Public Health about this. And in my idea for a commentary related to this, and they actually are interested. Nobody's talking about it. Yeah, everything's cool, and you know, you smoke, you know, performance enhancer-ish. Have you heard anything in that area about performance enhancement? I have, and the use of cannabis, so playing ball. You know, you smoke before you play a little ball. You know, you just get a little looser. You know. Get there. It's true. I know a lot of people that smoke before they run. I like running. You know, and I don't know if it's true, but I'm wondering. I want to run better. So maybe I'll move to California where it's legal. So I hope I was able to clarify why there is a need for phytoepidemiology. And specifically because of the, Ron, you pointed out, it's a wild west out there with cannabis right now. A wild west. Every state is doing their own thing. You know, Colorado's lowering the bars to sell more. Arizona doesn't lab. California does whatever the feds say. Eventually, everybody's going to have to get on. Eventually, they're going to have to reschedule cannabis. And when that happens, we don't want to get caught unawares. We don't want to get caught without the tools, without the understanding of how we need to post-marketing, and sort of introduce it. Post-marketing surveillance, safety, waste disposal, labeling is going to be huge. I say do package inserts for those small dabs. Dabs, I had another slide to show you different products. One of them is called dabbing. Dabbing is smoking extract. Not distilling into an oil, and it's taking the extract, getting a torch, special pipe, and just blowing that pipe to melt the extract, which is hardened, and then take a hit of that. Now, the amount of THC you get is astronomical. And I know from personal cases that, you know, people I know and talk to who have done it, that some of them with asthma have gotten asthma attacks. So you may go into respiratory distress from dabbing. It's getting real popular. You know, all you have to do is take some flour and a heating iron that are used to straighten hair, and get some paper that you can heat with, I forget what they call it, and just keep it on there. You can make your own extract. I mean, there's so much going on that's not legal, that we're not sharing, that can cause harm. And the more this is, will the youth of the next generation be smoking more than the youth now? smoking marijuana has always been around. I mean, I don't know one musician that hasn't smoked weed. And safely. But we still have issues with youth, use amounts. The labeling for me is a huge gateway to adverse events. The lack of labeling. What's in this? They need to label what is the hydrocarbon content. Okay, it met the standard. What's in it? If there's any hydrocarbons, they don't smoke that? Oh, absolutely not. I think it should be zero hydrocarbons. Those are the kind of standards that we are trying to put into effect at STMI International. It's going to be long haul. It takes years to develop international standards. This is in the second year. So we may be working on this for the next, the rest of the decade. But I hope you can walk away with something new to think about and to stimulate your minds, and you heard it here first. Seymour. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.